Yesterday, our country celebrated its 250th birthday. How should Christians understand their temporal relationship to an earthly kingdom, even while our permanent citizenship is in God's eternal kingdom, as Joseph prayed this morning? This is no minor question, but a question that Christians have discussed, debated, and disagreed over even before the pilgrims sailed on the Mayflower. The question takes us back to the earliest days of the church in ancient Rome. It was probed by Christians for 1,500 years before Europeans landed on the eastern shore of North America. It is a question that is asked by Iranian and Chinese and Brazilian and Kurdish and Cherokee Christians today. It's a question that I would like to address in three sermons in the month of July. And these sermons, as I've been announcing, will launch us into a Wednesday evening series in the fall where we're going to explore the history of Christianity in America. And Lord willing, we are going to meet several very interesting individuals who can help us know how to navigate the perplexities of the present. Through the years, I have collected hundreds of student papers involving apologetic, cultural, and theological issues. Anecdotally, there are certain hot topics that engage students' attention at different times. Under the Biden administration, any guesses as to what the dominant issue was? Gender ideology. Before that, the dominant issue was marriage and sexuality. And recently, I have observed a significant increase in politically oriented papers reflecting on the themes of Christian nationalism, immigration, America's endless wars, and Zionism. Here are several sample titles. Wouldn't you like to read these? Welcoming or Deporting the Stranger, the Christian Perspective on Immigration and ICE. Just War Theory versus Pacifism in the Lives of Christians. Engineering to Kill, Can a Christian Engineer Design Weapons of Mass Destruction? The Ethics of Engineering Nuclear Weapons. Can a Christian engineer ethically work for the Department of Defense? Last semester, I had 8 students in a course called Pastoral Theology. These are all aspiring pastors. And what do you suppose were the topics that really engaged the minds of future pastors? Well, 2 wrote papers on Christian nationalism. A third addressed the Christian's relationship to Zionism. A fourth addressed a Christian view of illegal immigration and border enforcement. There was also a paper on why pastors should engage in regular weightlifting. So as you can see, we need to understand how it is that we live between two worlds, as John Stott put it in his famous book on preaching. How do we navigate this tension of living between two kingdoms? To borrow a phrase from Augustine, the great church father's thought father, we are not the first Christians called to live through challenging times. And America has provided wonderful opportunities for the expansion of Christianity, but also many challenges for the church. How did Christians respond to the American Revolution, slavery, Indian removal, Western expansion, world wars, segregation, and the atomic bomb? How did Christians shape American history, and how did American history shape the church? I'm taking our title, Living Between Two Kingdoms, from Augustine's famous book, The City of God. Augustine lived in a Roman colony in North Africa. He lived at a time when that whole Roman Empire was collapsing. And he argues that all humanity ultimately belongs to one of two symbolic cities. The city of God is the kingdom of Jesus Christ. It is composed of those who love God above all else. It is characterized by humility, faith, obedience, and eternal hope. Its true citizenship is heavenly and eternal. Its citizens long for the new creation, the city of Jerusalem that Joseph prayed about this morning. The earthly city, or the city of man, is composed of those who love self above God. It is characterized by pride, ambition, and attachment to temporal power. It seeks earthly glory and ultimately passes away. Now, these two cities are not identical to visible institutions like the church or the state. Not everyone who attends a church is automatically part of the city of God. Nor is there any such thing as a truly Christian nation. Rather, the two cities are intermixed throughout history. Within empires, nations, and churches, people have a primary loyalty to one city or the other. And that loyalty is manifested by love. Augustine put it succinctly, two loves have made two cities. The love of self, even to the contempt of God, made the earthly city. The love of God, even to the contempt of self, made the heavenly city. Now, I am aware that there is a quote-unquote chosen nation theology alive and well in America today and in many churches across this great land. It views the United States as God's new Israel. And that theology landed in America with the Puritans. We will examine it in due course. Suffice it to say here that just as God had one primary nation through whom he worked in the Old Testament, Christians throughout the centuries have alleged that God likewise has one primary nation through whom he works with the advent of the New Testament. Roman Christians, after the conversion of Constantine, came to view the Roman Empire as God's new Israel. This is his new kingdom. But for many Christians, the mantle of the Christian nation within was passed to the Byzantine Empire, or to Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire after that, or the medieval papacy. More recently, many Christians in the British Empire viewed England as English Israel. It was the white man's burden to colonize and to Christianize the world. The mantle of New Israel was then carried to the United States by many Puritans. In fact, I was taught as a child that America is God's Israel today, and if America ceases to exist, the church will collapse. Now, there are a good number of nations that have also declared themselves to be Christians. Many, in fact, have constitutions that contain substantially more biblical language than our own. Armenia is widely recognized as the first Christian state, dating to 301 AD. Historically, Ireland, Russia, the Frankish Empire, Belgium, Denmark, Iceland, Greece, Costa Rica, Greece, and Papua New Guinea, and many others have declared themselves at one point or another to be Christian nations. But what does the Scripture actually say about all of this? What does the Scripture actually say about a chosen nation or a Christian nation? Well, let's turn to two passages, and I want these passages to just really orient this whole series. The first is 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2. And in a moment, we'll turn to Revelation chapter 5 also. 1 Peter chapter 2 and Revelation chapter 5. Peter's comments in 1 Peter 2 sweep away much of the Old Covenant, just as the author of Hebrews has been doing in our series on Hebrews. Whereas the Old Covenant saints built a temple of stone to last for as long as the world endures, the New Covenant temple is not located in the heart of a nation. It doesn't adorn the capital city. The temple is not a geographical destination for pilgrims coming to Jerusalem. Rather, Jesus ascended into a heavenly temple and into a throne room where he rules all the nations. The author of Hebrews is going to make that argument as well. And with a new temple comes a whole new race of people, a new priesthood, and a new holy nation. But that nation is no one particular nation on earth. It has no geographical boundaries at all. Would you notice the rather pregnant language of verse 9 describing the church? Peter writes, "But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." In the Old Testament, friends, there was a chosen race of people. There was a Levitical priesthood. There was a holy, that is, a separate nation through whom God's purposes were mediated out to the world. But suddenly, the momentum of the entire Old Testament is just reoriented, and it's reinvested into a new people of God. Just as Jesus is the new Adam, the new Israel, the new Moses, the new Aaron, and the new David, so Jesus has a new people. Jesus has a new and holy nation. This is the city of God that Augustine referred to, the holy people of God. The new nation has no defined border. It has no capital city. It has no central temple. It has no standing army. And in fact, its sovereign sits on a throne in the heavens. And believers everywhere comprise this holy nation, regardless of their race, heritage, or earthly citizenship. But notice, this new people of God still lives in the world, in the earthly kingdoms of men. We live as light in the dark places of the world. So what is our primary relationship to those earthly kingdoms? Well, notice the equally peculiar language of verses 11 and 12. "But I urge you," he's talking to the church, "as sojourners and exiles, to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God in the day of visitation." God's new people are indeed a nation, a kingdom, but they are a nation of exiles living out in the world. Ours is a holy mission to live uprightly when surrounded by evildoers. And Peter further explains that our mission is not one of anarchy or rebellion, but to live in submission to human government. Verse 13, "Be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil, and to praise those who do good," and thank God for good government and emperors who actually carry out God's justice. Paul makes a similar argument in Romans chapter 13. Now, neither Paul nor Peter assume that the emperor is a Christian. Nevertheless, Christians ought to be good citizens and support righteous legislation and good governance. Now, much more could be said here, but notice especially verse 16. "Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God." And of course, the primary freedom that Peter speaks of is our spiritual freedom in Christ. Our true and ultimate freedom does not relate to our Roman citizenship or American citizenship, but to our heavenly citizenship. True freedom involves our resisting evil and living as God's servants. Now again, much more could be said, but would you pay very careful attention to just two words? Just two words in verses 9 and 11. In verse 9, the word is priesthood. And in verse 11, the word is exiles. Those two words capture a tension concerning living between two kingdoms. Israel's priests were central to the culture, ethos, festivals, and worship of the nation of Israel. They lived on offerings, or literally on taxes. They maintained the temple and sacrifice. They became instructors of the law. Priests were, in other words, fully integrated into the life of the nation. No one was more central to national affairs than the priest. And that's the Old Testament background. Those priests were absolutely integral to the life of the nation. But an exile was precisely the opposite. An exile, by definition, is an outsider. An exile is someone driven away from his home, his culture, circle of friends, and family. He doesn't belong where he lives. Under the Old Covenant, an exile or a sojourner was banned from the priesthood. In fact, if an outsider attempted to intrude into the Aaronic priesthood, he was to be executed. Imagine that. So these two terms, priest and exiles, communicate this very important tension of both belonging and not belonging. And that is the tension that I think every true Christian at some point feels, regardless of his or her national citizenship. Wherever you live, whatever country you're from, there's a point at which you feel like, you know what, as a believer, I don't really belong. But yet, I do belong. We live in the cities of men. That is true. But we also belong to another city. Now, the ancient epistle to Diognetus is one of the earliest writings that we have that describes the life of the early church. And it beautifully describes this tension that was felt by the new people of God as they began to wrestle with the teaching of the New Testament. And it illustrates this tension with the illustration of the soul's relationship to the body. Listen to these words. To sum up all in one word, what the soul is in the body, that are Christians in the world. The soul is dispersed through all the members of the body and Christians throughout the cities of the world. The soul dwells in the body, yet is not of the body. And Christians dwell in the world, yet are not of the world. And the epistle continues, the soul is imprisoned in the body, yet preserves that very body. And Christians are confined in the world as in a prison, and yet they are preservers of the world. That, I think, really beautifully speaks of our obligation to the cities in which we live, to exercise godly influence, to speak out against evil, to speak truth to the nations, to speak truth to power. We are priests, priests indeed. And yet we are exiles, as it were. We are imprisoned in this broken world, and we are longing for the new creation to come. We are Daniel living in Babylon, regardless of where we live. A Chinese Babylon, an Australian Babylon, a Russian Babylon. You just pick your city. You're a Daniel living in the cities of the world. Now, would you turn to Revelation chapter 5, and let's notice one more, a very important passage. And notice how the people of God are described in Revelation chapter 5. Revelation 5, Jesus, the resurrected Lamb, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, has come to the throne of God. The ascension has happened, and He is resurrected, and He possesses the scroll, the title deed to all the nations of the earth. He is the worthy champion who now sits on his throne in his temple, and he subdues the nation. So how do we respond? Well, notice verses 9 and 10. And they, the people of God, sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation. And you have made them a kingdom and priest to our God, and they shall reign on the earth." Now pay very careful attention to that phrase, a kingdom of priests to our God. Notice the word kingdom is singular. Christ has one great kingdom. But the word priest is plural. Many priests, one kingdom. But where do we find all these priests? Well, the previous verse is explicit, friends, from every tribe and language and people and nation. If they have been gathered out of every nation, then at one point they were distributed through every nation, right? If you've gathered them out of every nation, they were distributed throughout the nations. Whereas Israel in the Old Testament was a singular nation of priests, shining Yahweh's light to the other nations, the new kingdom of priests is distributed through the nations. At no point in the New Testament are Christians told, "Well, go found a Christian nation." The New Testament does not give us a national constitution or blueprints for a temple. It does not actually give us anything like the Mosaic Law, which indeed prescribed both religious and civic laws. We don't find that in the New Testament. But here's what we do find. We find a great commission in which a singular kingdom of priests are to go to all the nations and disciple them all. That's the New Testament's mission. Our duty then as New Testament believers is indeed to function as priests in the nations where we find ourselves exiled, and to call those nations to embrace Jesus Christ. And indeed, I might add that the more priests that you have working in a nation, the more Christian influence you'll have. Dr. Dunn and I talked about this many years ago, and he and I agreed that America, from the very beginning, has had a very strong Christian influence. And that's because, if you think about it, there were many, many, many priests who came and they exercised their influence in our country. And in my estimation, there is no doubt about it. America has had a profound Christian influence from its inception. Christianity's influence on America has really been profound. And so I hope in this series, especially on Wednesday nights, to really introduce you to some of these great priests who have exercised considerable influence. And I think they are very relevant for us today. But at this point, I want to explore just a little bit of our history and kind of set us up for where this is going. And I want to talk momentarily about the American Revolution, because this is a thing that we just celebrated yesterday, our 250th birthday. The American Revolution, first of all, was in fact a period of religious depression for the churches. In the 1730s and 1740s, the colonies experienced what we now call the Great Awakening. But afterwards, churches experienced a period of distraction, disruption, and decline. The fires of the Great Awakening began to burn low. Per capita church membership declined. You might be surprised by this, but some historians have really done the work on this and have demonstrated that in 1776, church membership was actually substantially lower than it is today. Roughly 1 in 10 colonists in 1776 belonged to a church. Those churches, of course, varied across the spectrum in orthodoxy. Some of them quite good, some of them not so good, some of them downright apostate, just like today. Today, about 4 in 10 Americans
belong to a church. In 1776, many ministers who favored the side of the British simply went back to England. It was a very difficult time. Some said, hey, we're out of here, going back home. Other ministers were drawn into the chaplaincy. In some cases, they preached a sermon, went home and got their hunting rifle and left. You know, they joined the army, and who's going to preach next week? Well, we don't know. They vacated their pulpits, and it was really challenging. And church members, as you can imagine, were preoccupied with the burning questions of the war. Many colleges, even those founded for training men for the ministry, were closed down, and their dormitories were used for housing troops. So it was a difficult time for the churches. Number two, religious rationalism and deism crept back into many churches. The First Great Awakening in the 1730s had resisted the encroachment of Enlightenment deism in the American colonies for a generation. In the 1760s and 70s, it returned. The European Enlightenment philosophers were widely read during the 18th century, and many of them were not friendly toward Christianity. As deists, they believed in God as the grand architect of the universe, but they denied that God actually revealed himself in the incarnation. Thomas Jefferson and many of the founding fathers were committed deists. In the so-called Jefferson Bible, Jefferson removed references to Jesus' miracles, and he left him buried in a tomb in Jerusalem. He did not accept the resurrection. Ethan Allen, the hero of Ticonderoga, was an outspoken Enlightenment thinker. His work, Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, avowed natural religion, attacked the priestcraft of the Bible. Among the English, none equaled the impassioned eloquence of Thomas Paine, the great pamphleteer of the war. His Age of Reason became one of the foremost expositions of deism. So this was a problem for the churches. And thirdly, many churches were in fact ill-prepared to survive in the revolutionary environment. Anglicanism, as you can imagine, suffered a devastating blow. It was very strongly associated with the British crown. Methodism also experienced a decline because John Wesley was fiercely opposed to the American Revolution. The Quakers, who were very influential in Pennsylvania and Rhode Island, came to be targeted because of their pacifistic ideals. They did not fare well through the Revolution. Now, the Presbyterians fared much better, as did the Congregationalists. Many were from Scotland and Ireland, and they didn't care about the crown anyway. They didn't like the British, so hey, let's grow our Presbyterian churches. And you might have guessed, the Baptists did just fine. We Baptists, we always do well, right? In fact, the Baptists grew very rapidly in the First Great Awakening. They fared the Revolution okay, and they really grew during the Second Great Awakening. But it was a challenging time. Now, the fourth observation is this. God, in His mercy, sent our country a second great awakening. A second great awakening in the aftermath of the American Revolution. The roots of this go all the way back into the 1770s. Really, the Great Awakening proper is the 1790s, all the way up through about 1840, a very long awakening. And this second great awakening shaped the American church in profound ways. And I'll have much more to say about it on a later occasion, but for now, let me just limit a few details. Colleges were especially affected by the awakening. Timothy Dwight, who was Jonathan Edwards' grandson, was appointed president of Yale. And you notice among the student body this general sort of spiritual malaise, and this fascination with Enlightenment philosophers. And so Dwight instituted a preaching cycle in chapel where every 4 years he would preach through every major doctrine of Scripture. And the sixth year of that cycle, an awakening just swept right through the student body. The Second Great Awakening also led to the inauguration of the Great Century in Christian Missions. Adoniram Judson, very famous American missionary, not the first, actually, as he's often said to be, but a famous missionary, was actually a product of a Second Great Awakening. Mission boards and mission agencies proliferated through the new century. You know, when you go online today and you're looking at mission boards, there are a lot of them. You ever notice this? You're like, where do all these mission boards come from? Ever wonder that? Where do they all come from? Answer, Second Great Awakening. Many of them have their roots in the Second Great Awakening. Also, publication societies multiplied during the Second Awakening. These included organizations like the New England Tract Society, the American Bible Society, and the Baptist General Tract Society. You think about all the publishing houses that we have in America today and all the printing of all the different Christian. Where does it all come from? Answer, the roots of all that, Second Great Awakening. The Awakening also stirred up humanitarian efforts in the new nation, especially in the areas of abolitionism, Native American rights, and teetotalism. The Sunday school movement also came to America and channeled its energies into the biblical instruction of Native American children, although I might add, not always with success. All right. And finally, many new Christian educational institutions came out of the Second Awakening. This includes William College, Andover Theological Seminary, Hartford Theological Seminary, Princeton Seminary, and the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. Now, I've just barely scratched the surface, but the fact is that Second Great Awakening was profoundly influential in shaping the future of America. It's also safe to say that in the aftermath of the American Revolution, there were Christians who exercised their priesthood in our young nation in very important ways. In fact, even before the Revolution, there were Christians who exercised their influence, and I think in many ways went a long way toward helping us get to where we are today. I can point to Roger Williams. Roger Williams was America's first Baptist and a notable defender of religious freedom and separation of church and state and justice for the Native Americans. He wasn't the most easy guy to get along with, that is true, but he did stand for many things that were right and just. John Witherspoon was the president of Princeton. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And he left an indelible mark on the development of theological education in America. In fact, to this day, students come from all over the world to attend seminaries in America. And that goes back to men like John Witherspoon. Samuel Davies, the great Virginia Presbyterian pastor, promoted religious liberty. In those days, there was much persecution of Christians if you dissented from the Anglican Church in Virginia, and he stood against it. Ezra Stiles was the president of Yale, and he promoted biblical models of government. He began to give a lot of thought to, okay, if we're going to have a government here, how does the Bible influence government? And perhaps Dr. Furkeluck can tell us more about that. I'm sure he can. Isaac Backus was a prominent Baptist pastor during the Revolution, and he advocated for religious liberty and separation of church and state. By the way, his church to this day still preaches the gospel. I've been there, met the pastor, and it's still just faithfully preaching the gospel. And John Leland, another Baptist, influenced James Madison toward religious freedom. We have much to learn from so many who exercised their priesthood even while living as exiles in the new nation. But at this point, I want to make just two really important clarifications. All right. First, those who exercised their priesthood had to resist past evils, even as we do today. As historians Rodney Stark and Roger Fink put it, nostalgia is the enemy of history. Now think about that. Nostalgia is the enemy of history. Right? If it sounds too good to be true, it's probably not true. All right? By the way, there are whole books out there with sermon illustrations from American church history, and most of that stuff is actually not true. All right, I hate to say it, but one of my missions in life is to train young preacher boys to use accurate history. If they don't do that in their sermons, I really grade them down. Okay. Anyway, we want to be very careful that we don't accept a glamorized view of the past, or we will fundamentally misunderstand the evil that people in the past have resisted. Peter said, "We have been called out of darkness into his marvelous light." And Christians in 1776 believed that applied to them. It applies to all Christians in every generation. You resist evil in your time. They were not aware that they had just given birth to a Christian nation. In fact, they were aware of darkness around them. So to be true to their legacy, we must really take up the mantle of speaking truth to the nation whenever there's evil. Let me return momentarily to the example of John Leland. John Leland was a stalwart Baptist preacher, pastor in Massachusetts and Virginia, and indeed was an outspoken proponent of religious liberty. He influenced Madison and Jefferson. But liberty, said Leland, must extend to the slave. To the General Committee of Virginia Baptists, Leland introduced the following resolution, resolved, that slavery is a violent deprivation of rights of nature and inconsistent with a Republican government, and therefore recommend it to our brethren to make use of every legal measure to extirpate this horrid evil from the land. Friends, don't glamorize the horrid evil or gloss over it. This was an evil that arrived at our shores in 1619, a year before the Pilgrims. If you excuse the slavery, you will never appreciate the work of a man like John Leland and so many other Christians who labored to overcome it. As another example, consider Jeremiah Everts. Everts was a student of Timothy Dwight. We always read about the Great Awakening, these students that came to Christ. So what did they do? What happened to them? Well, in the Second Awakening, Jeremiah Everts dedicated his life to the cause of the Native American. And Everts became the most outspoken opponent of Andrew Jackson and his Indian removal policies. Jackson's Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer John Meacham said of Everts, in speaking out against the forced removal of Indians from their homes to lands west of the Mississippi, Everts was to Indian removal roughly what William Lloyd Garrison was to slavery, a force calling the country to respect the right and dignity of a persecuted people. Friends, that is the priesthood. That is the Christian exercising his priesthood. And if you're unwilling to assess the evils of Indian removal, you'll never appreciate a man like Jeremiah Everts. He's a phenomenal individual. He spoke truth to power. And secondly, we also want to humbly learn from the mistakes of past Christians. For example, some of the strongest Christian voices for evangelical Christian in America were strangely supportive of slavery. Jonathan Edwards, who actually was not an American, he was a British subject, but we think of him as an American, he owned slaves, including a teenage girl named Venus and a young man named Titus. Cotton Mather, the great Puritan preacher, preached Native American genocide in King Philip's War. His sermons are really quite shocking. But friends, think about it. How many of Israel's ancient priests were just perfect models of Christ-like behavior? How about Israel's first great high priest, Aaron, the brother of Moses who introduced idolatry? The golden calf abomination is just a shocking interlude into the tabernacle narrative. But true history just tells the whole story, right? You have to tell the whole story. We can learn from the successes as well as the mistakes of those who have gone before. And if there were no perfect priests in Israel's history and no perfect apostles to found the church, don't expect anything like perfectionism from America's past Christians. It doesn't exist. Again, nostalgia is the enemy of history. But as we conclude today, I want to take us back to the year 1607. On April 26, 1607, three ships, the Susan B. Constant, the Discovery, and the Godspeed, carrying 105 men, landed at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay to plant the colony of Jamestown. Their biggest mistake was the failure to bring women. You can't plant a colony without women. It doesn't work. The colony struggled immensely for its survival with periods of great sickness and great starvation. The pastor of that little colony was a man named Robert Hunt. He was a pastor in the Church of England, and he is thought to have preached the first gospel sermon in English that we know of in the New World. Pastor Hunt took an old ship sail and he stretched it out in a triangular formation between three trees. And that sail served as the roof for the first church. He then took an old piece of timber from the ship and he nailed it up between the trees, and that piece of timber served as his pulpit. And on June 21st, 1607, 2 months after landing, Hunt held his first church service in Virginia. And on that occasion, he celebrated in that makeshift church the first communion that we know of in what later became colonial America. Imagine that, the first communion. Robert Hunt, along with many others, died during that first year, but his church survived. Captain John Smith, the leader of that colony, reported that a rather homely church shelter was soon constructed of crude pieces of wood and earth. But it burned to the ground. After 10 years, in 1617, a permanent church building was then constructed. And today, the foundation of that building can still be seen. There was a later building standing over the site, and inside is a plaque that commemorates the earliest American Indian convert who was actually baptized in that church. His name was Chunko, and apparently he was converted around 1622. Further to the north, in the colony of Salem, in 1628, John Eliot began evangelizing Native Americans. Eliot learned the very difficult Algonquian language, and he even translated the Bible into the Algonquian tongue. That was the first Bible printed in America. Did you know this? The first Bible printed in America was actually printed in an Indian tongue. It was published in 1663, more than 100 years before the first English translation was printed in America. Did you know this? In fact, there were very strict copyright laws back in England, and they would not allow for any English translations to be printed in America until during the Revolutionary War. So this Indian Bible was printed, again, more than 100 years before any English version. And that Bible was used to go out and to plant a Native American Wampanoag church in a place called Mashpee, Massachusetts, in the year 1648 by disciples of John Eliot. And today, the gospel is preached, and communion is still celebrated in that old Indian meeting house, as it's called. And to the best of my knowledge, it is the oldest gospel-preaching church in America today. It's an Indian church. Now, friends, my hope in this series is to encourage us all, after more than 400 years now since that church was planted. Well, I should say since John Eliot. To just go right on exercising our priesthood, even as we live as exiles, longing for the city of God. I want to put just a few pictures up here, if they can show them. There we go. And there is that church down in Jamestown. Anyone been to Jamestown and seen this church? Okay, that's the church. This is a much later building. But if you go inside, you can see the floor of that earlier church from 1617 still there. And here is a plaque to Mary Chanko, the Indian youth converted to Christianity. And just around the corner is a little monument here to Robert Hunt. Anyone seen this monument to Robert Hunt? You have to go looking for it. You have to know it's there. And if you look closely, you can see that sail tacked up in the trees. And here's his pulpit over here, an old piece of timber. And he is administering communion to this motley bunch of guys who came over in 1607. And here is John Eliot's translation, the first Bible. This is actually a later edition, but the first Bible printed in America. There's the book of Genesis. And here is an old Indian meeting house. And again, to the best of my knowledge, this is the oldest gospel-preaching church in America today. This is the inside. And would you believe, I don't know if I told you this or not, when I was reworking the Constitution for our church, I got their Constitution and their, covenant, and I used it in writing ours. I actually connected our church to this church. Did I tell you that? Maybe I never told you that. Did I tell you that? I connected our church to this Indian church, the oldest gospel-preaching church in America.